Hello and welcome to Criminal Justice Knowledge. My name is Natalie Miller and I'm very pleased to welcome my guest today, Professor Shara Stone, one of the faculty members here at Humber in the Community and Justice Services Diploma Program, teaching in courses such as interviewing skills, interpersonal skills, community correctional practice, in the Criminal Justice Degree Program, in courses such as social policy, comparative justice, or comparative criminal justice systems, as well as social problems, and at the University of Guelph Humber in the Justice Studies Degree Program, in criminology, restorative justice, and youth in the law. Thank you so much for joining me today, Professor Stone.
Thank you.
So we're going to be talking about critical race theory today. So what is critical race theory?
Critical race theory suggests that we need to be looking at how crime is socially constructed, and particularly how it's socially constructed around race. There's five central tenets in critical race theory. One is the necessity for storytelling, or for counter-storytelling, or for providing a space where people of race can talk about their experiences, mm-hmm. And have those experiences heard, but not only have them heard, but have them listened to, have them legitimized, mm-hmm. and have them taken into account as a fundamental necessity in understanding how crime is constructed and how crime impacts on different communities. The second component of that suggests that racism just exists. It is mm-hmm. what it is. It's ordinary. It's part and parcel of what we deal with every single day. And it's one of the reasons why people who don't experience racism have difficulty understanding it or grasping it, is because mm-hmm. it is just part of what we do. Mm-hmm. It's not exceptional. And it's permanent. It's permanent because it's been embedded into our structures. It's been embedded in our economic systems. It's embedded in our legal systems, in our social systems, in our political systems. Mm-hmm. So because it's part of what we see and what we do all the time, it's like we're fish in water. We don't see the water.
Right.
We just know we're fish.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it's so ordinary and permanent, we don't question why it is that that people of color do not assume positions of power in this country. It's mm-hmm. understood that those positions of power should be held by people who are predominantly white.
Right.
Right? And it's seen as something that's kind of cool when Justin Trudeau, for example, says, "Oh, I'm going to make my cabinet diverse." I was like, "Well, why does he have to make his cabinet diverse? If we were a diverse and multicultural community, as we say we are, we would see that diversity and multiculturalism reflected throughout everything we do."
Mm-hmm.
But we think it's kind of cool. That's because the racism is so embedded and so ordinary that we just accept it as being what it is.
Right.
Which also means that it leads to the third tenet, which suggests that the tenet is called whiteness as property. Right? But what that means is that people who are white in particular have access to have the right of possession. They, just as men have the right of possession of women.
Mm-hmm.
Right? White people have the right to possess people of other colors, cultures. How do we see that? If you think, an example of that would be cultural appropriation.
Mm-hmm.
Perceived to be an okay thing to wear a First Nations headdress to Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't understand what the problem with that is. Or for someone to wear a sari as a Halloween costume.
Right.
Okay? Because in our whiteness, we have the ability to take what is others mm-hmm. and make it our own, not because it's something that we fundamentally believe, but because, we're entitled to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't think about how that's differently perceived based on who's wearing it.
Right.
So, for example, a white woman wearing a sari is perceived very, very differently mm-hmm. than a South Asian woman wearing a sari,
mm-hmm.
right? In terms of, she's wearing her quote unquote traditional dress, as opposed to, I'm wearing something neat and nifty.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And aren't I being culturally tolerant
Right.
When I decide I'm going to, no, we're not being culturally tolerant at all. We're actually being incredibly disrespectful.
Right.
So, but that would be one of those ways in which we see that right of possession,
mm-hmm.
right? That right to, the right to use and enjoy
mm-hmm.
what belongs to others.
Yeah.
So another example of that would be how we don't seem to think that there's fundamentally a problem with us taking all the oil out of the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
But when people in the Middle East have a problem with us taking oil out of their countries and rising up against us, we think, oh my God, they're terrorists. No, they're protectionists.
Right.
Right? From, if you think about it, if you know, and I talk a lot about empathy,
mm-hmm.
right? But if you put yourself in the position of someone else in another country whose resources are being stolen, they're poor, we're rich,
mm-hmm.
comparatively speaking,
mm-hmm.
right? But we don't have a problem because we have the right to it, right? I'm not going to turn down my thermostat,
mm-hmm.
you know, as Sam Richards has talked about in his TED Talks. So that would be another one of the tenets. The fourth one is that it's been very interesting to see how interests have been converted. So, for example, if you look at things long term,
mm-hmm.
one could argue that the primary beneficiaries of the civil rights movement have not been black people,
mm-hmm.
but have actually been white people.
Interesting.
Right? And you can see that in our education systems, for
mm-hmm.
example. Right? So who teaches what courses?
Right.
Right? If you have a course about First Nations people, is that taught mm-hmm. by a First Nations person?
Usually not.
If you have a course about gender, is that taught by a woman?
Definitely.
Or a trans
most likely
person?
Not. No. Nope.
Right? Not more than likely not,
mm-hmm.
right? So who's benefiting out of civil rights? Justin Trudeau, going back to Justin, and please, you know, I do think Justin's done some really good work. but if you go back and you think about Justin Trudeau, when he promotes this idea that he's going to be multiculturalism, who's
mm-hmm.
benefiting?
He is. Yeah.
Right? So there's an argument can be made that the primary beneficiary of civil
mm-hmm.
rights, you haven't seen people of color in particular being elevated,
mm-hmm.
but you have seen a lot of white individuals who have this profession and are doing great work, don't get me wrong,
mm-hmm.
but at whose expense?
Right, they're using those experiences that they've never experienced in their own
ways. And then the last one is to critique the whole notion of liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The whole idea, especially in Canada, where we are quote-unquote colorblind.
Right.
We don't see color, right? We just see people. No, actually, when you don't see color, what that means is you don't see who we are.
Right, yeah.
You don't see how our experiences are fundamentally different.
Mm-hmm.
Then your experience might be. It allows you in this beautiful multicultural framework,
right,
to literally deny the experiences, not even just the experiences, the realities
mm-hmm.
Of what it means to live in a different skin,
right,
in a skin of a different color.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if I use gender, for example,
mm-hmm.
as a woman,
mm-hmm.
I know that when I go out to my car late at night, I don't just walk to my car and open it up.
Yeah.
Right? First of all, before I leave, I make a decision as to whether or not I'm going to put my keys between my fingers in order to prepare for the possibility that something might happen to me.
Yes.
Then when I get to my car, I do a really quick survey into the back of the car to make sure that the car is okay,
mm-hmm.
That there's nobody in the car. I get in the car, I close the door really quickly. Often I'll lock the doors before I start the key.
Yeah, I do the same thing.
You do the same thing. This is part and parcel of what we do as women
mm-hmm.
to navigate our lives as women.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at me and you don't see me as a female,
right,
you deny that entire existence.
Right.
That
which is what
I have.
People are doing when they say they're quote unquote colorblind.
When you say you're colorblind, you deny the reality
mm-hmm.
that that the way in which people are criminalized is highly based in one's racial identity.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You deny the reality that I can sell drugs and not get harassed by the police.
Right.
But as someone of color, if someone of color sells drugs, they can be guaranteed they're going to be harassed. I think one of the challenges that we have when we are trying to work from a critical race perspective is putting aside, being able to put aside our own privileges to hear the experiences of others and to take those experiences and to hear them at face value mm-hmm. as what they are. And I think sometimes when we see ourselves or when one might see themselves as not having a lot of privilege, perhaps, you know, growing up in poverty,
mm-hmm.
Growing up in Ontario housing, not having access, but being white and saying, but hold on a second here.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that simple. And critical race theory says we recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
We know that that privilege exists on so many different levels, and that's where the intersectionality comes in. And it's really not about, say, my privilege is less than yours, or my privilege is worse than yours, or mm-hmm. my privilege is better than yours, or whatever. It's not really about that. It's about being able to say, hold on a second here. That's not my experience, but let me hear
right.
what the experiences are
mm-hmm.
of others.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not talking about a hierarchy of hierarchy of needs or a hierarchy
right.
of you know, like, well, who's got the worst
right.
privileged story around,
yeah.
right? And certainly one of the examples that I would use is that being here
mm-hmm.
at a higher learning level, being here at an institute of higher learning, having
mm-hmm.
the privilege of post-secondary education, if you think about this on a global scale, 7% of the entire world's population have the privilege
mm-hmm.
of post-secondary education.
Yeah.
So I would encourage anyone who's listening to this, regardless of what their racial identity, gender identity, sexual orientation, ability, etc., to think about,
mm-hmm.
is even if I show up as having none of that privilege, I am here. And
right.
that is a privilege the vast majority of people in the world do not have.
Mm-hmm.
I can turn on my taps with the expectation, forget Warburton for a moment, with the expectation that that water is going to be safe to drink.
Mm-hmm.
30 to 40% of the world's population do not have that privilege.
Yeah.
Right? So if we think, if we can knock ourselves down to having no privilege,
mm-hmm.
but the very fact we live in North America itself is a privilege.
Right.
All right. Because we have access to so much more
mm-hmm.
than the vast majority of the world's population. So if we can get away from this idea that, you know, of this competitive, whose privilege is worse than
right.
someone else's, and just start hearing the experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Of people and how those experiences may be very different from mine doesn't make them less valid, doesn't make them more valid.
Right.
It provides us with the framework for being able to say, yes, I hear you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not okay. And how are we going to work together as allies to figure out how we're going to change that?
That concludes part one of my discussion on critical race theory with Shara Stone. Please join us for part two on criminal justice knowledge.